Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books almost as much as the book thief loves books.
Damn, if only it were possible to love books as much as the book thief loves books.
Let's just go to a library and steal all of the books.
I steal books from the library all the time. I take them without paying.
Never pay, bitch.
That's right.
I'm a book thief too.
Kind of.
Sort of.
Not really.
Ish.
At all.
I will say that I was expecting more varied book thievery than the book thievery that happened in this book.
Yeah, that's true. The book thievery was stealing, like, all of 6 books.
From, like, one person. Yeah.
Basically with tacit permission.
Wait a minute.
It was about the level of thievery of me checking books out from the library.
Basically. So in case you haven't picked it up yet, we read The Book Thief this week by Marcus Zusak. And I would issue a spoiler alert, which we haven't done in, like, forever, so we're kind of terrible at it.
We kind of forget to do that.
The reason we don't have to issue a spoiler alert this week is because the narrator of the book totally spoils it multiple times, so...
Yeah.
You don't really have to...
He keeps dropping info. I guess we could put out a spoiler alert just because it's a somewhat recent book, and if there's actually going to be a major motion picture soon, we wouldn't want to spoil a movie.
That's true.
Since way more people are going to see that than read the book.
Yeah.
Despite it being a number one bestseller.
And despite the fact that this book will probably not make the best movie.
I don't see it translating very well in myself. Yeah.
Well, if you try to be faithful to it, if you just kind of translate the general story of The Book Thief, it could make a pretty good movie.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Books like this, because this one's kind of atmospheric, has a lot of information in there that wouldn't come across in a movie scene, but at the same time, I guess I'm thinking of, like, the Cider House Rules, where the book is over 600 pages and really atmospheric, and a lot of the good stuff in it comes from the attitude of the narration, and the movie was cut way down to work. Though the screenplay was written by John Irving, who wrote the book.
Interesting.
And the movie works pretty well. It feels a little incomplete after reading the book, but it seems like the movie is reasonably well-regarded anyway. So, I don't know, maybe it's possible to do that with The Book Thief, too. It's just I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, me too. I guess we will find out.
Yeah, well, plus the Cider House Rules cheated because they could get 50% of their movie's watchability out of just finding the cutest room full of orphans they could and putting them on camera. I guess those kids were most likely not actually orphans.
Probably not orphans. They probably didn't put out a casting call for orphans. Orphans only.
Orphans only. You must be this adorable to cross the casting line.
And they can afford to, like, not pay them because their parents are dead. And they're like, haha, you can't read our contract. Stupid orphans.
Dumb idiots. This is what happens when your parents die.
You just become stupid. Like Liesel.
That's right.
Because she couldn't read, like, a big dummy.
Yeah, what's up with that? It's because she was a communist. Because her family were communists?
Yeah, with a K.
Well, yeah, because it's German.
Well, okay, so we chose the book because it was time for a YA novel, essentially, and I heard a lot of good things about it, but when Ben and I were discussing it, we were wondering how YA it really is.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to how you define YA, because if YA is any book where the protagonist is less than adult, then it's definitely YA. But at the same time, the themes and some of the feelings in this book, to me, seemed more adult.
Yeah, the way it's written and how long it is made it feel more adult than YA to me.
Yeah.
Not like, I mean, you know, a high schooler could read it.
Oh, for sure.
But I don't know if a middle schooler, not that they couldn't read it, but it would be more difficult than other YA books.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I would have been interested in it in middle school.
Yeah.
Because I do think the writing style would have turned me away.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, I could be wrong.
Maybe there are a bunch of 13-year-olds who love this book.
Yeah, it could be.
13-year-olds who listen to novel ideas. Let us know your opinion.
Boy, you want to talk about a really small cross-section of a really small cross-section.
Fans of novel ideas and...
and 13-year-olds who are also fans of novel ideas.
Yeah.
The Venn diagram of that.
Like the Venn diagram from The Fault in Our Star.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway. I'm just going to try to reference The Fault in Our Stars every time we record a podcast.
Done.
So, regardless of how YA you think it is, it's definitely a World War II novel.
Right.
And it does not shy away from the horrors of World War II. So, there's that.
I guess it's time for our favorite part, the plot synopsis.
Don't sound so excited, Ben. Jeez.
Well, I'm trying to fit the attitude of the plot synopsis. I'm trying to think in straight lines, which is very difficult for me at this time of the night. and I formed my plot synopsis before I read the epilogue, so I had to make a small modification. Addendum. Yeah. And so the plot synopsis this week is, hope is dead and nothing is cool. JK. See if you can guess which part I added later. Psych!
Nothing is cool? Wait. yeah, so remember that spoiler warning we gave you earlier? Yeah, it turns out at the end of the book that bombs drop on the town of the main character, but the sirens don't go off in time and everyone dies except for her.
Rocks fall, everyone dies.
Yeah. And so Ben and I were like, oh crap, everyone just died, but you know, it turns out that not everything is horrible.
You know how when you ask someone if a book is good and kind of what happens in it and they snark back at you, everybody dies.
It's kind of true in this book. This book and Doomsday Book.
Right. When your
everybody
friend,
dies is an accurate analysis.
When your friend says that to you, they're not being sarcastic with this book. The Doomsday Book Thief. Possible episode title.
Amalgams of titles, man. Those have been happening lately. I'm
kind of into title amalgams. And that's why you are an amalgam. Nailed it.
What?
Parks and Rec reference.
Oh. Andy. I was like, what are you talking about? Nailed it. So brief summary for anyone who hasn't read this. It follows Liesl Memminger, who is a 9-year-old girl. At the age of 9, her mom drops her off in the German town of Mulkin, with foster parents, and then kind of disappears. Oh, her brother also dies on the way to the town. That's kind of significant.
It is kind of significant.
So, anyway, her foster dad's really nice and nurturing, teaches her how to read and all that, and her foster mom is a hard ass on the outside, but you know, nice person on the inside. And that's in 1939, so, you know, right at the beginning of World War II. And so it follows her adventures in the town, stealing books, making friends with the local kids, learning how to read everything, until her family takes in Max, who's this young Jewish man, who's obviously going into hiding, so he doesn't get sent to a concentration camp. And Liesl starts to learn some bigger shit about the world. And then, yeah, Max eventually leaves and then the town gets bombed and everyone dies. So, there's that. But the first part is more the meat of the book.
Right.
So, setting is, like I said, the German town of Mulking, which is a suburb of Munich, Ben and I don't actually know if it's a real town or not, because
we... That would require me to do research.
Hold ourselves to high research standards.
Arduous research, like typing mulking into Google and seeing if anything happens. I can even be doing that right this second as we podcast.
Yeah, whatever.
But I'm not going to.
No, we're just going to wonder out loud if it's a real town. Maybe you do the job for us.
That's right.
And like I said, it starts in 1939... Ends in, I don't know, 45,
43. Yeah.
Now, the point of view tense of this book is interesting.
Yeah, the book is narrated by Death.
Literally by Death. The character of Death.
The character of Death. The anthropomorphic representation.
Yep. Talks about, I don't have a scythe or skull face, you silly people.
That's right. He's just a, well, we don't know exactly what he is. He's just a dude.
Or...
with a presumably metaphorically circular heart.
Yeah. A genderless dude?
Possibly, probably.
Yeah, it's Death. I mean, we don't really know. No. What we really need to ask is if he has a dick, and then...
Yeah, that's
we'll
right.
Know, we'll know for sure.
Oh, hey, Death, do you have a dick?
That, by the way, is a joke.
Inside joke alert.
I would not recommend going and asking people if they have dicks. It's not a good idea. Yeah, so it's told from the point of view of Death. And what happened was Liesel, who is kind of the main focus of the story, had written down everything that happened to her before the bombing. And then after the bombing, the book got dropped, and Death scooped it up and stuck it in his pocket. So he's read this a bunch of times and is relating Liesel's story to us from what she wrote, and then a little bit of his own experiences. He's seen her a couple times, and then just kind of smattering of his experience in the war. So for the most part, it's the past tense while he's talking about what's going on with her, but then he does break occasionally and go into present tense and talk about he directly addresses the audience, basically, and breaks the fourth wall that doesn't technically exist in novels,
yeah,
but...
so to speak.
And tells us what's up in his feelings and stuff like that, so...
What would the novel equivalent of a fourth wall be?
I don't know. Because that's what it is.
Yeah, was there a term... Was there a term for that?
I'm sure there is.
I'm sure there was.
And I just don't know
it. Like, there were plays that broke the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Before novels were probably even a thing, I would guess.
Yeah, I guess that's true, that plays did exist before novels. So.
Certainly before novels were common.
I mean, I won't get into the history of plays and novels.
Right.
But that's true. Well, the fourth wall was not a term until later.
Well, I'm not surprised by that part of it. I don't know. Maybe they didn't worry as much about what tropes were. You followed conventions for certain things, and you didn't worry about what those conventions were named.
Yeah. You were just like, what if?
This is how we do it.
It's how it goes.
It's called Greek tragedy, bitch. Oh, Euripides. You and your filthy mouth.
Bitch. Well, if you've ever read the Lysistrata, then indeed. Aristophanes, at least, was a potty mouth. I don't know if it's just the modern translation, but like every other line, they're like, shut up, bitch. You're fucking cunt. These like... guys want sex, we won't give it to them.
I just like the idea of an ancient Greek playwright.
That's tragedy, bitch!
Walking around being like, what up, bitch?
What's the, that was so tragical, you totally got catharsis! Hola! I'm like, God, Socrates, shut the hell up. No one cares. Antigone's not even that good.
What did I just tell you? Shut
punches
up.
Punches him right in the face.
That's right.
Anyway.
Anywho.
That is totally neither here nor there. So, as we said, the narrator is Death, but Death is not the protagonist of the story. You can kind of make the argument that maybe Death's the protagonist of a story, since we said everyone dies and Death has to, you know, collect everyone's souls and stuff. But, really, Death is not the protagonist of the story.
Death is the protagonist of very few stories.
I would argue almost none. I don't know if I've ever read a book where Death is the protagonist.
I think he might have been in one of the Discworld novels.
Oh, well, I mean...
But that Death is kind of a goofball. Also, speaks in all caps.
Oh, is that where you got that from?
Yes, that is where I got that from.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
So who is the protagonist?
Liesel.
Liesel.
Assuming that's how you say that name.
I think it is.
All right.
I think you had a friend named Liesel.
Huh.
When... Well, maybe still does. So based on my tiny anecdote of knowing one German person who maybe had a friend named Liesel. God damn. The standards for this podcast. Soaring.
I think they're actually going down.
Soaring.
I didn't think that was possible.
The heights of the sky.
There's just going to come a week where this podcast isn't even a book podcast anymore. It's the two of us giggling about inane bullshit. For an hour.
Basically, that's what it already
is. It's not that far off, yeah.
Oh, jeez.
That's okay. A fair point.
Sorry, guys.
Like, this week we're going to podcast this book, and then we're never going to mention anything about the book again.
We should totally do that.
We need to get popular enough so we have something that gets requested a lot, and then totally do that with that book.
Totally. A plus, yes.
Hopefully, if we ever get that big, those people won't go back in the archives and listen to this.
And then murder us.
Damn it! Are we ever going to get them to read book X? No, you're not. Or you are, but we're just not going to talk about it. Even if we like it.
So protagonist, Liesel. Like we said, she's 9 when she first shows up, is 13-ish at the end of the book. Well, I guess she's technically an old woman and then dead at the end of the book.
Yeah.
Laughing at that.
At the end of the book, she is not a thing.
But in the main story arc of the book, she's like 9 to 13.
Right.
So let's talk about Liesel. What's she like?
So, Liesel, to me, almost, and this word amalgam is just going to come up all the time.
Yes.
To me, felt kind of like an amalgam of a bunch of different YA protagonists. She is kind of fiery and feisty, and I guess not as directly tomboyish in the sense that most tomboyish protagonists at some point are like, I'm kind of a tomboy.
Yeah.
And she just runs around and gets in the dirt and plays soccer and kicks the crap out of boys.
Mm-hmm.
And she has these deep feelings. She's experiencing the world in a way that's both childish and becoming not childish. And I don't know, it all feels like very standard YA stuff to
yeah.
me.
And I mean, she's a good character, but it's true that I don't think there's really anything about her that I hadn't seen before. She's kind of like a weird mix of, like, Scout and Lyra,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description.
Except German. Which...
Right.
Yeah, so...
It's whatever the German word for Scout is and Lyra.
Right. And I guess... kind of her initial thing is that, because she is the book thief, I guess, we didn't mention that directly, and the first book she steals is a book that a grave digger drops in the snow after burying her brother, and she just picks it up because it's a connection to her dead brother, but she doesn't know how to read. And this is kind of like the first irony of the book, is that, you know, this character's the great book thief, but she doesn't actually know how to read at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. That's, I guess that's really the way that she bonds with her foster father
mm-hmm.
when she moves into that house, is they're teaching her to read, and maybe to some small degree learning to read together, because I gather his education is not that fantastic. Yeah. But I don't know, because she has this connection to reading and to words more than even reading.
Yeah.
And she doesn't get the chance to read all that many books when you get right down to it. She reads the same half dozen 1,000 times, I think.
Yeah, she has, like, the original grave digging guide she picks up. She gets 2 for her birthday or for Christmas. She steals 1 from a book burning. She steals 3 or 4 from the mayor's wife. And then she, I guess, reads another one in Max's book and her own book that she wrote.
Right.
So that's like 10 or 11 books.
Yeah. Not tons.
Although I guess you could assume after the events of this particular story, she might read a bunch.
Yeah, probably does.
Although, I just think it's interesting, so you were saying she forms a connection with her foster father learning how to read, and then she forms a connection with the mayor's wife by learning...
Over books.
Also, again, over books, yeah. And I thought it was interesting that they described that she would have, like, 6 books on the floor, and she'd read, like, a couple paragraphs of each one at a time. And I was like, how the hell are you keeping those books straight?
Maybe she's not.
Yeah, maybe she's just, like, taking in words and trying to...
Yeah. Yeah, she has books... She forms her connections with a lot... almost everybody over books, except for Rudy, who she just runs around the town with.
I mean, he helps her steal a couple, but...
Yeah, but the words aren't there. Mm-hmm. That's not the key component with them. And I guess I wanted to throw in, before I moved away from Liesl's character, that I agree with you that she is a good character, just not a unique character.
Mm-hmm.
Lest anyone think that I'm criticizing her, because I actually enjoyed seeing the story kind of, sort of, through her eyes.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. I just thought of an alternate plot synopsis for the book this weekend. It's just, yeah, books!
Yeah, books!
It's the perfect novel idea as a book to read.
In a lot of ways.
The main character loves books as much as we do.
In a lot of ways.
So aside from Liesl, who else do we have?
Well, her friend Rudy.
Rudy Steiner.
Who has been mentioned. He's a blonde-headed... this is kind of an ironic way to describe him, but he's kind of a blonde-headed Aryan dreamboat.
Oh, yeah. Blonde hair, blue eyes, strong and athletic, really smart.
Yeah.
And the Nazi party's like, put him in one of our schools.
Right. We want this to be one of our future leaders, officers.
And yeah, he's like a perfect representation of what we're looking for.
His father refuses to let them take him, and he isn't a big fan of the party anyway. Though yeah. Partly based on that incident.
Rudy, yeah, is not... Well... I think the good example of how he's a bad Aryan is at the beginning it mentions it was during the 36 Olympics in Germany when Jesse Owens was poning everybody. And I guess for any listeners who don't know who Jesse Owens is, he was a black Olympic athlete who kicked some ass running.
Yeah, well, Hitler was hyping up the Olympic Games as, you know, most countries do when they're about to have the Olympic Games, and a chance to show off how amazing the country is, and
Hitler... to prove Aryans are the best.
Looking to prove the superiority of all of his Aryan athletes, and then in comes Jesse Owens and the track and field events, the one, you know, the Olympic events that people actually care about.
Yeah.
And destroys everybody.
Fastest man in the world for a long time.
Yep.
And then Hitler was like, oh, boo. A black man was faster than Aryans.
Yeah.
And then he cried because he's a little bitch. Rudy, watching the 36 Olympics with his family, decides Jesse Owens is fucking cool. And so he goes to the track out by their house and rubs coal all over his face and hair and everything. Essentially blackfacing himself.
I say one of the few,
in a respectful way.
One of the few non-insensitive uses of blackface.
And then he goes running around the track pretending to be Jesse Owens, and his dad comes and finds him and was like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Dad, I want to be like Jesse Owens!
I am Jesse Owens.
Yeah, and that was a good moment of not only, like, do you get a sense that Rudy is not a racist D-bag, but then his dad says, you can't say that. You do not want to be Jesse Owens. Everyone else should want to be you. And his dad doesn't believe that, but he's trying to explain, like, the Nazi stance to him of...
Yeah.
You're blonde hair, blue-eyed, white. Like, you shouldn't want to be Jesse Owens.
And explaining the nuance of that to a 9-year-old is probably impossible.
Yeah.
And so instead you say, you... No.
Just don't say that.
Especially publicly, no.
Yeah. And I liked that particular moment.
It was a very innocent kid, kind of the, I don't know, cute kid thing to do, I guess. But not in, like, an annoying, forced, cute kid way.
Yeah, and then you had, like, the ominous overtones of, like, what's happening in society at the same time.
That one moment is really the moment from which Rudy draws most of his charm.
Yeah. It's very true.
Because for the rest of the book, he's fine. He's kind of vaguely amusing in the way that adolescent boys are kind of vaguely amusing when they're annoying adolescent girls and you are yourself not an adolescent girl.
Yeah. And I mean, I did think it was kind of, I think what the point the author was trying to get across was because Rudy has to join the Hitler Youth, because everyone had to join the Hitler Youth, as far as I know. You are much more an expert on that than I am.
That seems right.
And his, like, particular group leader is a douche, and so Rudy is like, the Hitler Youth sucks! And it's just because this kid's, like, a total dick to him.
Right.
And it's kind of, like, pointing out the importance of relationships and stuff that, like, I mean, Rudy probably wouldn't have been very good at getting indoctrinated into that belief system anyway, because he's outspoken and likes people and his family's not like that.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like, well, yeah, I guess if you joined the Hitler Youth and, like, your group leader was maybe not nice, because I don't think they're allowed to be nice, but, you know, was fair and wasn't an a-hole, then maybe you would buy into the Hitler shit more, because, you know, it'd be like if you really liked the Boy Scouts. It's like, oh yeah, I get to go to Hitler Youth today. Which seems like a weird thing to think, but...
Well, the... I guess the parts of it, the political parts of it, are more the trappings of it, because if you're doing athletic events or doing outdoor stuff or doing crafts or whatever it is that your particular group is into, then that's what you associate with it, and the Heil Hitlers are more coincidental.
Yeah, like, you have to say it. It's almost like a reflex.
Yeah.
Yeah, Heil Hitler, whatever. Now let me run. Yeah, so
I'm trying not to compare that to saying the Pledge of Allegiance to school and that sort of thing.
Well, obviously the Pledge of Allegiance to Heil Hitler, different connotations.
Kind of.
But it is kind of the same thing of, like, a kid, like, mindlessly just repeating something, because...
Yeah, that's kind of...
You're supposed to.
That's more what I was thinking.
Okay. So, aside from Liesl's best friend, we also have her foster parents.
Yes.
So, Hans Huberman is her foster father. And he's kind of, like, the best foster father you could ever hope to get of all time.
Yeah. He is, like, understanding and kind in a way that can only exist in fiction, probably. He plays the accordion.
Yeah, he plays, apparently, like, a boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's super nice. Liesl wakes up in the middle of the night having nightmares about her brother dying, and Hans will go and just sit with her all night and, like, sleep in the chair next to her bed, and eventually starts using those couple hours she's awake in the middle of the night to help teach her how to read. He's also an anti-Nazi guy, hasn't been accepted into the party yet because he's too nice to Jews, basically.
Yeah.
And so he has that whole thing going for him, too, of being, you know, the soft-spoken, gentle soul kind of guy. He does chain smoke like crazy, but...
Yes, he does. He does like to smoke, but...
It is...
But who doesn't?
It is the early 1940s, he's
smoking
so.
Right now.
Whatever. Such a liar.
That's not true yet. Gabs wouldn't be able to talk because she'd have her shirt held in front of her face.
Yeah, that's very true. Be too disgusted.
That's right. And
it did make me wonder how his, like, two real kids were such turd baskets.
Yeah, or at least you would have thought the son would have taken a little more. But I guess the daughter was just doing the grown-up kid thing.
Yeah.
But the son was... I don't know how he got so politically indoctrinated opposite of...
Because he was just, like, a Nazi folks. Bastard.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Oh, there's a question that I forgot to put in the question. What happened to that dude?
Oh, yeah. Well, he went to Russia.
Yeah.
That's all we know.
And as far as we know, wasn't dead there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Suffice it to say, he's not really important enough to discuss in depth. So who cares?
That's right.
So Hans, and then his wife, Liesl's foster mother, is Rosa Huberman. And she is a foul-mouthed woman with a cardboard face, according to
whatever that means.
You think of, like, John Kerry, how his face looks like it was roughly hewn out of a plank of wood.
I'm trying to figure out what the cardboard equivalent of that
would be. Yeah, so, you know, her three favorite words are Saumunch, Saukerl, and Arschloch, apparently, which are German swears.
Yeah, basically... Pig, female edition, pig, male edition, and asshole.
Yeah, and the other thing people call each other in the book is Schwein.
Schwein.
Because at one point Death is like, German people love pigs. Y'all are obsessed. That's why they like their sausages so much.
I get you, that must be.
But she's totally like the, you know, hardcore mom who's, like, constantly yelling and making Liesl go out and do all this work and yelling at her husband all the time. And then she turns out to be, like, a good person. So, at first I was just like, dang, like, evil foster mom, nice foster dad. And then, like, when Hans brought Max in, for example, the Jewish guy they had in their house for a while, she's just like, okay.
Oh, this is what we're, of course this is what we're doing.
Yeah, he gets part of, like, the dinner fare, like, same portion as everyone else. She takes care of him and ends up being, like, a super kind-hearted person. And then you're like, oh, okay. So, she sounds really mean. She might smack you around, but she loves you in her own way. She's one of those.
Yep. We know the type. How's about Max?
Yeah. So Max's father fought in World War I with Hans, and his father got Hans out of a battle one day by saying that he had beautiful handwriting and should be writing letters for the general or the captain.
Whoever, yeah.
And it turns out that everyone else in his platoon or whatever they're called... who went out into that battle that day got killed. So Hans felt like he owed his life to his friend for getting him out of the situation, and went and offered his wife and their little baby son any help that he could give. And it turns out that the family was Jewish, and, you know, what is it, like 19 years down the road, or however many years later, they finally take him up on that offer, and Max, who's the son, shows up, and Hans takes him in. It's kind of an interesting way to acquire a person to hide in your house, but also showing that Hans is a good dude.
Yep. A man of his word.
Yeah. Max himself, I wrote in the outline that he's a quiet and thoughtful guy, but he's kind of quiet and thoughtful because he has to be. Because he's, you know, in that situation where he has to hide and be really quiet and...
Yeah, kind of thoughtful and quiet in the way that someone who gets beaten a lot sits in the corner and is thoughtful and quiet.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously been screwed up by the whole situation of... being screwed over by Germany and put into hiding and all that stuff. And I was actually surprised by how much he got to interact with the Hubermans.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you were going to hide someone in your house, and as long as you kept your curtains drawn only at appropriate times of day or night, the person you're hiding could actually roam around the house a little bit more than you'd think. Though not being able to leave would still suck, obviously.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting because a lot of stories you hear about, like, Jewish people hiding out, they're, like, in the cellar or in the attic, and, like, they never get to leave it, and they just have to be, like, totally quiet and, you know. And in this situation, people come down to the basement and chat with him, and they let him come upstairs and sleep on the bedroom floor by the fire in the winter. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, huh, that's new and makes sense. I mean, unless you're in one of those situations where, like, Nazis are banging down your door every other day looking for people you could be hiding.
Right, or you're living in a tenement or something. Mm-hmm. But if you're in your own house, I mean, being under house arrest for months and years wouldn't be good, but it'd be a lot better being locked in an attic.
Yeah.
Getting food past you when it could.
Yeah. Like, the original situation he was in, he basically was hiding in a closet or whatever it was.
Yeah, I don't know.
Getting food, like, once every couple of weeks.
Whenever someone could pull it off.
So. And he's also screwed up because he was with his entire family, and he had a good friend who found Hans for him, and said, well, you know, he can only take you, so he ended up leaving his mom and his aunt and some of his cousins behind, and he feels pretty crappy about that.
Yeah, he has a lot of that guilt thing going on. For sure. Feels bad about leaving them. Feels bad about endangering
the family.
Yeah.
Imposing on them too much.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the bright spot, the one bright spot in his existence is silly, quirky little Liesel.
Yeah. And that's really the big thing. Like we said, how Liesel forms a lot of her connections through books and words, and she and Max definitely share that. She reads out loud to him, she reads some crosswords, and he ends up writing her a couple little books and talking about her importance in his life and that sort of thing. You know, because he's trapped in this place, and the only way he can lash out is through, like, little private sketches and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm sure this was entirely intentional on the author's part. The fact that he tears up the copy of Mein Kampf and paints over all the pages white and then writes his own stuff all over that. So he's actually, like, writing, you know, these little sketches and stuff about how crappy Nazi Germany is, and he does it over whited out pages of Mein Kampf, which is just...
Right.
An added delight, I'm sure. Ha, fuck you, Hitler. I personally liked his imaginary boxing matches with Hitler.
Yeah, that was interesting. I'd say all things considered, he could have been a lot more angry.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he wasn't not angry, but I don't know. Maybe, I guess it's not like you'd be in a position to just be lashing out about it all the time, but I think I would not. I think I would not discuss the matter quite as calmly as he does. Like, he's having these visions and this, talking about this strange, twisted little man, and not just any time Cedric can be like, fuck that guy!
Yeah. Yeah. I guess he'd be tempting to do that. Although maybe at some point, if, like, you're just living in that state of horror and fear all the time, you're just like, I'm too tired to be mad about this all the time.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just kind of generally pissed, but can talk about it calmly. I mean, his situation is better than a lot of other Jewish people at that time. Although,
yeah, at least until he leaves.
Yeah, he leaves and does end up in a concentration camp.
Yeah, ends up in a work camp, as opposed to an extermination camp, which I'm not sure is that much better. I was surprised he was still alive at the end of the book.
Yeah, he makes it to the end of the war, guys.
Yeah, weirdly.
Would not expect that.
Yeah, he and Alex Steiner, the involuntary soldier for not giving his son over to the Nazi school. And it's like, those are the two who live, really? The one who probably got sent to Russia and the one who is in Dachau?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think those labor camps were, I don't think the long-term survival rate was probably that great.
No.
Though I know Dachau had, by the standards of those camps, a low body count. You know, something in the tens of thousands only.
Yeah, as opposed to,
as opposed to a couple million.
Yeah.
At some of the facilities designed for liquidating people.
Ugh.
Yeah. But still, he was captured in 1943.
Yeah, made it to 45, I guess. Is that when they were all liberated?
Yeah, I mean,
or 44, do you know?
Can't imagine that.
The bomb was dropped in 45.
Well, yeah, my timeline's not exactly on. I don't know that they were penetrating all that deeply into Germany in 44.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Guys, listen.
I'm exhausted.
We just don't know fucking shit, okay?
I'm exhausted, and I'm not, and I don't know anything.
Well, let's just give benefit of the doubt and say caught in 43 and liberated in 44. So, possibility of him surviving that is
less,
better than,
yeah,
like, 42, 45.
Right.
Okay, so let's go ahead and move on from characters to moral issues. I'll go ahead and bring up my feminism, because I got to do that.
No.
We're going to read a book at some point where I'm like, I don't have anything. It's the perfect representation. Men and women split down the middle and they're all great.
That's right.
So, I don't really have any, like, horrible specific complaints about the book. I have specific complaints, but nothing that's, like, the worst thing ever. It's not, you know, a 1950s science fiction book. So Liesl, as we mentioned, is kind of tomboyish in the fact that she runs around, plays soccer, beats up some boys, her best friend's a boy. And at some point during the book, I realized, are any of the kids in this crowd that runs around town all the time girls? They never mention a girl Liesl's age who is friends with her.
I know. The moment Gabs pointed that out, I said, maybe there just aren't any.
She's the only one.
And then I decided that, in fact, there were not any.
Because that's funnier.
That is much funnier.
But I think that was kind of weird that Liesl's the only girl her age, and then the other women in the book, who are all adults, most of them...
are broken?
Yeah, because you have... we mentioned briefly the mayor's wife. Her son died, and so she's just super screwed up from grief, from her son being dead. Won't speak most of the time. Kind of finally starts to get a little better toward the end of the book. You have Liesl's foster mom, who I mentioned initially, seems like she's just a mean person who yells a lot. She does get fleshed out more, though. And then you have this woman who is the Huberman's next-door neighbor, whose basic only characteristic is to spit on their door when she walks by, because she's mad. And someone I forgot to mention when we were doing the outline was Frau Diller, was the woman who owns the convenience store in town and is, like, an uber-Nazi. And I'm like, that's it. And I was like, okay, so is Liesl, like, the only well-rounded female character in the book? And I do think the adult women grow and get better as the book goes on, but that is a strange thing that I noticed. And I do think it is kind of weird that there are, like, no girls her age who are her friends.
That is a little strange. Because kind of unlikely.
Even if you are a tomboy and friends with boys when you're young, like, you're gonna have friends who are girls, too. Because I feel like a lot of people are like, well, if you have friends that are girls when you're a young girl, then you're all just girly together. I'm like, well, me and my girlfriends, like, ran around and climbed trees and got in trouble for rolling around in mud in the creek and stuff. Like, right? Doesn't really mean you're like, girly. You can have friends that are girls, so.
You can do both.
Yeah.
Be so-called girly sometimes, and I don't know, like, rolling around in the mud isn't a boy's activity. It's a kid's activity.
That's just being a silly kid.
Exactly.
Yeah, but if you're taking, like, stereotypes at face value, then, yeah.
Of course, yes.
Oh, when I was young, too, I was stupid, because I grew up with three brothers, so my mom was always like, I'm going to buy you this shirt. I'm like, it's pink. I hate pink. And then I hit a certain age and was like, oh, right, I can wear pink and, like, be a girl, and it's okay. It's okay to do that. Okay, so other than that, I brought up the racism issue just because when you're Nazi Germany, you kind of have to bring up that issue.
Kind of the issues that come along with Nazism.
Yeah.
You know, just living in an oppressive society like that and the racial element, which is kind of the key element in Nazism.
Yeah, I mean, we already mentioned the Jesse Owens incident, mm-hmm. So, you know, being black is bad, and
right.
Then, of course, the whole, like, Jewish thing, which you might not consider Jewish people to be a race, but there's definitely racism against Jews.
Right. And, I mean, in this book, it's presented more in the form of... just kind of like something that's hanging in the air, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't... I guess you see the attitudes there to some degree, but you don't really meet people who are racist shitheads. Other than maybe guards with whips.
Yeah, because Liesl's, you know, her family is obviously protecting a Jewish man... And then her best friend and his family aren't all crazy and racist.
Yeah.
So yeah, you never really meet anyone who's like a big factor in Liesl's life who is completely over-the-top racist or anything, but...
Right. There's just, you know, there's a little bit of... There's some discrimination within that, within the town, just... It almost seems like it's a thing that they have to do on their public face more than a thing that they really want to do, though I'm sure there are some of them who also want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the starkest realization of that was all the Jewish shops in that area of town that had been
right
fucked up and
looted out and broken and
the graffiti and stuff on them.
Right.
That was the biggest, oh yeah, moment.
Mm-hmm.
But gave a quick nod to Kristallnacht and then kind of moved on, but...
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of hard to definitively say that here is the town as a whole's attitude when there were no Jews there to illustrate the point.
Right, because they'd all been run out. And again, maybe not run out because everyone in the town legitimately hated Jewish people and didn't want them there. Some of them just doing it kind of because they had to, but at the same time.
Right. Well, I think that was one of the purposes of the book as well. It's kind of... As I start to nudge into theme territory here, but kind of showing how individuals can still be, you know, just people within a repressive, oppressive society like that, and how the people who, the run-of-the-mill person who isn't making policy is a lot of times just caught in the middle of a lot of shitty stuff, starting with institutionalized racism and moving onwards towards being in a war zone when you're a non-combatant, which is maybe the second shittiest part of World War II after, you know, death camps.
Yeah, I would just say probably the shittiest.
Pretty hard to put that in second to anything.
Yeah.
Not that Stalingrad was a bed of roses.
Yeah.
But that civilian populations were legitimate targets despite having nothing to do with the actual fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know this book has, like, nothing to do with England, but that is one of my favorite things about England, is that during World War II, when they were dropping bombs on London, British people were, like, on the roof of St. Paul's Cathedral, like, get those fucking bombs off our cool history, man! Throwing them and shit. Or, when we were in Stratford-upon-Avon, they told us that the town purposefully burned down all of the houses around Shakespeare's house so that, like, the house next to Shakespeare's couldn't catch on fire and then burn down Shakespeare's house.
Right.
I was like, oh my god, you guys are crazy as shit. But, you know, when you're targeting stuff like that, you kind of gotta do what you gotta do. That was kind of neither here nor there. I just wanted to mention it. But yeah, there's, especially in Hans, in Liesel's foster father, you see a lot of that at play because, I mean, they're harboring a Jewish person in their house, he's against Nazis and doesn't like it, and they're watching a group of Jewish people being marched to a camp, and he feels horrible for them, and without really thinking about it, just walks up and offers a crust of bread to one of them who's, you know, falling down and starving. And,
yeah.
And it ends up being horrible for his family. I mean, well, he gets whipped on the spot, and then he's freaking out because he thinks the Gestapo is going to show up and do all sorts of horrible stuff to him. And then he ends up getting enrolled in the party and sent off to war zones. Because he tried to be a nice person.
Yeah.
And so you have that whole inner conflict there of, like, here's something I don't agree with, I want to do good things, but if you do something good, it can screw you over. And so, like, are you more interested in trying to do the right thing or, like, in your own well-being? Which I think was a problem a lot of German civilians had to deal with. And how you can say that a lot of them probably didn't agree with that stuff, but they were just too afraid to do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a decision that you should have to make.
Well, other than that, possibly the main theme in the book is the power of words.
Yeah, that.
And so in our... I'm just going to try to carry this as much as I can.
You're going to have to.
I am already.
You are. I'm dying.
In our copy of the book, there is just a short little interview with Marcus Zusak after the text, and he mentioned that he thought it was really interesting to bring up this whole issue of people reading and writing and bringing words into this sort of society, and the power of words in Nazi Germany. Because he talks a lot about the Führer's words and how he's, you know, captivating people and using his words to kind of weave this spell over the country, almost. And then Liesl and Max, in their little rebellions of writing against the Führer and going out and reading books that, you know, they shouldn't read. So I think I mentioned it a little earlier. Liesl actually steals a book out of a bonfire at a book burning. And book burnings were, you know, to get rid of things that the people should not be exposed to. And she ends up reading that book out loud to a bunch of people, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
And so he's kind of demonstrating that, you know, the power of Hitler's words versus the power of these other people's words, and, like, casting their rebellion in that light as opposed to direct action, necessarily.
Well, and how having perhaps the freedom to use whatever words you want makes it more difficult, perhaps, to suppress that direct action, or, you know, you mentioned kind of like the idea of having a spell over the country, and how that word Führer just keeps coming up over and over and over again, and how that almost becomes this, what is the word I'm looking for? See, here it is, the power of words. Whoa! But it almost becomes a thing that when you hear it, your mind goes to a certain place, you know? And now, when you're reading the book, it doesn't go to a good place, necessarily, but like the woman who is obsessed with Hitler and Nazism, mm-hmm. I don't know, the fact that he was always referred to as the Führer and never as Herr Hitler,
mm-hmm.
How that is kind of some power in and of itself, and mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe we're supposed to get a little bit of that out of all these Salmensch and Sal Carol over and over and over again.
Terms of affection.
Yeah, yes. They become that way.
Yeah, I just want to start calling people Salmensch.
But how Liesl has a certain gift for finding the right phrase or the right words.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of her deal. The word shaker.
Yeah. It's kind of her bag.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are a couple instances. So before the entire town gets killed in a bombing, there are several moments where, you know, they all go to the shelter during, like, when the sirens are going off and everyone's freaking out, and Liesl just starts reading one of her books out loud because she's freaking out and she thinks that'll help calm her to read this book, and it turns out that everyone else calms down too and just listens to her read. And so every time there's an air raid going on and they're all down in the shelter, Liesl will just read out loud to them. And so that's another example of the power of language and words.
I don't know, just because it's on our list, maybe mention the idea of loneliness being part of this book as well.
Mm-hmm.
Liesl coming to her foster family, having, you know, having lost her family. How the loss of her brother sticks with her so powerfully.
And then the loss of Max.
Which is the loss of Max. Familiar? Or Max, for that matter, mm-hmm. being lonely himself, and in his case, not having lost his family, but feeling like he's abandoned them, and
Then
maybe Hans kind of being the only person in town who would outwardly show any friendship towards the Jews.
Uh-huh, and you have Ilse Hermann, the mayor's wife, who's lonely because her son's dead and her husband works all the time, and so she just kind of wanders around the house by herself.
Yeah.
Or even Frau, what's her face?
House Puffle.
And the next door neighbor, her husband's dead, I'm assuming, and her two sons are off at war, and so she's all alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of her sons dies, and the other one comes back, and she's devastated, and then her son that survived kills himself, so then she's, like, really alone. So
yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe her getting killed wasn't horrible for her.
Yeah.
That's pretty rough.
I don't know what she really had to live for at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I guess, again, one of our points of interest, I just wrote down the word shaker, which is what Max ends up calling this collection of stuff that he's writing and sketching. And he actually wrote a little short story called The Word Shaker about the power of Liesel's words, essentially, in this scary forest. And the strength that the two main characters derive from each other, which is basically him and Liesel. but just the fact that he's acknowledging the power of her words and words in the world. So, comes up a lot. Okay.
Okay.
Strengths of the writing.
Well, the writing is pretty poetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's I don't know if I'm gonna juice it all the way up to flowery, but
no, I wouldn't call it flowery.
No, but it's descriptive without going overboard. Like, it includes more descriptors than a lot of writers would use.
Good use of metaphor.
Mm-hmm. It reads, I don't know, like it has that literary tinge to it, even though I'm still not exactly sure what that's supposed to mean.
Well, that's kind of one of the reasons it doesn't necessarily feel like YA, is because the writing style is a little more sophisticated than usually seen YA novels, for that reason.
And at the same time, it reads very naturally, because a lot of books that use language this well, or that where the words themselves kind of become art to some degree. I don't know how much that's going on in this book, but I've read a couple books where that was clearly the intention, and even when that is well done, you can tell that that's the intent, and I didn't really get that too much from this book.
Yeah, it was obviously carefully crafted, phrases chosen carefully. These little interjections by Death and Boldface in the center of the pages pretty often. Those were obviously very careful and deliberate, but none of it ever felt like staged. I guess I'm just going to use a bunch of theater references tonight. None of that ever felt inauthentic, even though it's pretty apparent that the author was very careful in choosing all of that stuff. And it reads pretty easily for that reason. So even though, you know, the writing's more literary, if we want to call it that.
Right.
It's still easy to read, so like pretentious drivel or anything.
Right. And the little asides by Death were kind of a fun, cute little touch that helped keep the tone from getting too heavy. And there were lots of lists. Lots of, oh, something's going to happen and it's going to feature these three things, or here are three things that happen, and it'll state them in kind of more general terms, and then you'll get a little bit more story. And
yeah, here's the 13 gifts Liesel gives
Max. Yeah.
Here's the seven-sided die was one of the chapters. Yes. So the seven things that happened with Max in the house and stuff like that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. And then we were kind of wondering if whether or not the book is too long, basically.
Yeah, it is. Our copies, at least, were more than 500 pages, which is another reason we were like, YA novel, it's more. I mean, I guess Harry Potter's a YA novel, and those are more than 500 pages.
Well, yeah.
But it is pretty long, and it doesn't feel really draggy or anything. I'm sure there's something that could get cut out. I didn't really bother to think too hard about it, because I was never reading at any point and going, oh, God.
Yeah, me neither. It was never It was never a slog.
Yeah.
It was never boring. It was actually pretty easy to read. Surprisingly easy to read for a book that uses language the way this one does. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. It might need editing. I have kind of been thinking that it's less a book about moments and little interesting points and more one about kind of just atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're doing stuff, don't get me wrong, but what they're doing is maybe less important than how they're doing it and what they're saying and feeling while they're doing it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons, which is the main reason why I'm skeptical that it'll translate to screen to bring it all back around.
Yeah. I'm not positive it's gonna work. Okay, so, we have, I guess we now have two questions for the book. We originally just had the one, which is, what happens to Max? Because, like we said, we know he survives the camp, because he shows up again afterward and finds Liesl. And we know that Liesl goes off to Sydney, Australia, for some reason, and hangs out there for the rest of her life, but we don't know if Max goes with her, or if he stays in Germany, or if he goes off and finds his family, or what.
Yeah.
We don't get any closure there. We just know he lived.
I'm sure there was some searching for his family and friends and relations. I think that was probably... I would guess, even if I hadn't read a little bit about it, that would be a common activity for people who'd survive the camps.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we don't know what he does with the rest of his life, and as one of the two significant characters to actually survive, seems relevant, I'm just saying.
So, what happens to Max? And then, of course, Ben's question of, what the heck happens to Hans and Rose's weird Nazi son?
Yeah.
Because we know he was in Russia. We don't... Death never specifically said that he died there, so... We don't really know.
Is he dead somewhere in Stalingrad? Does he come back to Mulheim and...
feel like an ass?
Nah, I don't know. I don't know. Our verdict. Did you like it?
Dad.
Okay.
That was interesting. I liked... It was a little bit of a new take on the story of World War II. It didn't focus entirely around... the Jewish struggle, which I don't know if that tends to happen a lot in this kind of literature, if you just think it does, because it's the most memorable thing about the war. Mm-hmm. And actually, in my opinion, the scenes with Max and the Jewish struggle were the most memorable parts of the book. So, I don't know what that says about me. So I thought it was good, but I'd read a lot of stuff on the internet where people really, like, recommended it strongly, and I was expecting to kind of fall in love with it, and that didn't happen.
Maybe if it was the first thing you'd read along those lines, it would be more powerful. That's a thought that I just had. Because I kind of agree, there were interesting things about it. I like Liesl. I thought the narration was interesting. Not just the premise of it, but the execution of it.
Yeah.
I did enjoy the way the book was written, but it didn't... It's not really going to leave a lasting emotional impression on me, I think.
Yes. Well, Ben, I was talking about, you know, like, the entire town gets bombed and everyone dies. And normally when that sort of stuff happens in a book, you're like, oh, shit. And then you're, like, scarred for life by it. Like... Again, to bring up Doomsday Book.
Yeah.
When the entire fucking town gets wiped out by the plague, and I was just depressed for, like, an entire day afterward. Yeah.
That book punched me in the gut. This book, I was surprised when that happened, but I wasn't, like, outraged or depressed or anything. I was
like, oh, fuck.
I was like, oh, shit, all right, that's a big gesture.
I did think it was pretty sad that Liesl never kissed Rudy until after he died, though.
Ah.
But then I was like, well, whatever.
He didn't deserve it anyway. Filthy boy.
Stupid boy.
Stupid Rudy. So, what you reading right now?
Well, I was kind of trying to think of what I want to talk about that I've been reading. Because after we finished last week's, I actually did burn my way through two vampire romance novels that were both pretty silly. That a friend lent me. One was called How to Marry a Millionaire Vampire. Although I thought the title was misleading because they didn't even get engaged until the very end of the book. And I was like, this has nothing to do with How to Marry a Millionaire Vampire.
That's right.
And then the other one's called A Quick Bite, which was about vampires, but they're actually like super beings enhanced by nanotechnology created in Atlantis.
These things happen.
Very strange. So I read those. But I guess what I'm currently reading is today I picked up A Ring of Endless Light by Madeleine L'Engle. It's tied into the other book I was just reading by L'Engle a couple weeks ago. Yeah, that's all I got. All
right. I'm reading The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, which is nonfiction, and it is about the architecture and building of the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, and also about H.H. Holmes, who
was a
crazy person and the first... or generally viewed as the first American serial killer.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that book. If anyone's down for listening to 40 to 60 minutes of podcasts, Stuff You Missed in History Class did a two-part episode on H.H. Holmes. That was really interesting.
Yeah, definitely, I'd say my initial impression from the book and from doing a little bit of poking around on the life of H.H. Holmes is that he had a career. That seems to be the word that gets used with serial killers, even though it's kind of a weird one to use, that would not have been possible probably even just a decade or two later. Yeah. 'Cause it was just an interesting time in Chicago. And people, people trusting other people in a way that no longer exists made a lot of this stuff possible. And
Yeah. The
way that people are, the way we society keeps track of people, you can no longer build a giant murder castle, spirit a few dozen people away into it, and just say, oh, that young lady, she moved to California.
Yeah, you definitely can't get away with that.
That doesn't work anymore. People ask questions.
Just saying.
If nothing else, people notice they haven't been updating their Facebook for a while.
Yeah, she posted this status about staying at this weird dude's house. And nothing happened. Actually, one of the things they talked about in the podcast that was interesting was, like, several people escaped getting murdered by him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, he could do a super charming bit, and they'd be staying there, and they'd be like, this guy's, like, a weirdo, and this room is... it feels off. Yeah. And then they would just, like, leave.
Yeah.
And then, like, 2 days later, he'd murder a different person. It's like, oh, okay, so... His uncle included, actually. He tried to murder his uncle.
Yeah.
His uncle's like, you're a creepy weirdo.
I just read about that. Well, it's weird because it's again, what I was saying about the time period, and I know we're on a little bit of an aside, but that's okay. But,
it's interesting.
Like, some of the description of his behavior, like, he would make eye contact just a little bit longer, and he would touch people in a way that was unusual in society at the time, and... basically, all the descriptions of his charm in the book sound just like the guy who would be ostracized now for being the weird, creepy guy on campus or at the office or wherever.
Yeah, right. Like, if you met a guy and he was, like, touching your arm, like, hey, what's up? You'd be like, get off of me right now.
Right, like one of those arm touchers who just stands a little too close and makes eye contact just a little too intensely, who, like... if not for those things, would be hitting all the correct social cues. And so if you have never heard of that or run into someone like that, then I don't know, like, if he was the only one in the city of Chicago, people would be like, oh, like, he's just a friendly, touchy person. Instead of, oh, no, he's going to murder you for sure. Run away.
Yeah. Man, that guy's nuts.
So, yeah. Yeah, anyway.
He didn't need to add about H.H. Holmes or the book thief.
But especially H.H. Holmes.
Especially.
You can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can send us an email at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us on the tweeters or whatever it is, @novelideaspod.
And you can find us on iTunes.
And if you do, rate, review, comment, etc., etc.
So next week, for Halloween, we are reading The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which I just discovered, like, a minute before we recorded by Googling it, is a short story and not a book.
I had no idea either.
No idea. I just thought, because of its prominence in American society and how many fucking Sleepy Hollow spinoffs there are, that it had to be a book. But no, it's a short story.
It's a really iconic short story.
Yeah, apparently. It's so iconic, I thought it was a book.
It's a good fit for us, I think, because it's significant.
And because The Book Thief was so long and we're late with the episode, that'll help us out a little bit.
Or a lot.
Written by Washington Irving, or Irving Washington.
Yeah. One or both.
Yeah.
Catch 22 screwed me up forever on that. On that name. I think that does it.
Yeah,
that'll do. So, okay, great. Yep. Then we'll see you next time.
Bye.